Good morning. Welcome to the July workshop meeting. So if we could start the meeting off by saying pledge allegiance to the flag, I would.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, thank you very much. What I'd like to do is introduce two new board members, and I'll ask them to say a few words. We have Mr. Kaczynski as yes. Joining us today, and he's a replacement for Ms. Pandek.
I'm Gary Garzinski, a developer from Northern Virginia, and been involved in, Virginia land use and planning for quite a number of years in my positions as past president of the Home Builders Association of Virginia in 1990, and also as the National Association of Home Builders president in 2002. Past president for, I think it was 4 or 5 years of the Northern Virginia Transportation Alliance. And most recently, I've served on the Prince William Economic Development Task Force and a 20-year service with the Virginia Housing Commission. And I am currently a director of the Federal Home Loan Bank of Atlanta, a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania and the Wharton School. Married with 3 children, I reside in Clifton, Virginia, in Fairfax County.
Well, thank you very much, and we look forward to working with you, and thank you for agreeing to serve on the Commonwealth Transportation Board. We also have Mr. Rich.
Yes, sir. My name is Jim Rich. I'm from Fauquier County, from a huge metropolis called the Plains, Virginia. And I just recently retired as an attorney with Shell Oil Company. I had served on the board in the past under Governor Allen. And it's an honor and a pleasure to be with you all. I look forward to working with you.
Thank you very much, and again, welcome. I would also like to say I'm serving in 2 new roles today.
Congratulations, sir.
Congratulations.
I've been appointed by the governor to be the commissioner, so I'm not the acting commissioner, I'm the commissioner now, and thank you, and I look forward to working with the board. We have a huge challenge in front of us, and with the executive team and the staff of VDOT, we look forward to carrying out the policies that you set. So thank you very much. My other new role today is the Secretary of Transportation will not be here today, and so as chairman, I'm going to try to guide us through the agenda, and hopefully I can do that same way the secretary would do it, but probably won't be as good. But we'll give it a good shot. I would also like to take the liberty as chair, maybe changing the agenda. We have the mayor of Richmond, Mayor Jones, and he would like to address the board. And Mr. Jones, Mayor Jones, you would come forward.
Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to the Commonwealth Transportation Board. I'm Dwight Jones, Mayor of the City of Richmond, and I'm delighted to be able to stand here in this role rather than in the role of sitting around the table in meetings like I used to do when I was a member of the General Assembly and like you're doing now. I want to congratulate Mr. Worley on his appointment as VDOT Commissioner. Had the opportunity to work with him for 15 years while I was in the General Assembly, and I know about his depth of knowledge and his enthusiasm for this job, and I'm really happy to see somebody who's paid his dues finally get to win the prize. So delighted to see that happen. I want to talk to you a little bit, just a brief moment, and I won't trespass, as we used to say in the General Assembly, trespass on your time too long, but I wanted to talk to you just a minute about high-speed rail, or more appropriately, dependable rail in the Southeast Corridor. And I know that all of us are anxious to keep this project on the right path, And I'm absolutely amazed at the cooperation that we're receiving regionally, amazed at the cooperation we're receiving from elected officials and business officials around the area to make this a go. And I think that we're uniquely positioned to make high-speed rail a reality in the Southeast Corridor between Virginia, Richmond, and North Carolina. And I'm not telling you anything you don't know. It's a game changer for the Commonwealth, a game changer for the region. We are right next door to the nation's capital, but we really don't have a quick way to get to the nation's capital. We have citizens and business people and government officials and military leaders who need a train connection to Washington, D.C. And so I asked to appear before you today because I'm absolutely passionate about this notion, and I wanted to be able to say for myself and on behalf of the city of Richmond, tell you about the importance of high-speed rail for us as a city, and to say in particular that high-speed rail has got to mean a stop in downtown Richmond. It's got to mean a stop at Main Street Station. Why is that important? It's walking distance from the Capitol, walking distance from the federal courts, walking distance from the Federal Reserve. And it is important because it is a game changer for our region. And I don't have to tell you, because all of you are aware of what happened in Atlanta with MARTA and with the airport changed from a good city to a great city. Charlotte, with changing the bank laws and a great airport, turned into an awesome city. But yet neither of those cities had the advantages that we have in the city of Richmond. And as any good realtor will tell you, it's location, location, location. We're 90 miles from the nation's capital. We are the most obvious next step for high-speed rail on the East Coast Corridor, and we are wanting to move the ball forward on this project. Transportation solutions like airports, light rail, and high-speed rail are game changers, and I know that you are aware of that. Now, I've been a part of government for a long time. Thelma and I served in the General Assembly together, and we know that government moves surely, but it moves very slowly, like a glacier in most instances. It takes forever for us to get anything done. But the truth of the matter is that this is so important that we've got to move quickly on this. Last month, the board took the wonderful action of putting together a three-year project to bring passenger rail service to Norfolk, from Norfolk to Washington. And that was a laudable project, and I want you to know that I support it. I've talked to Mayor Frame and expressed my congratulations to him. It's a golden opportunity for Norfolk, and we're happy to see rail service come to Hampton Roads. However, there is a caveat, and that caveat is an important one. Because from my perspective, from the city of Richmond's perspective, we don't want to see trends develop that would permanently bypass stops at Main Street Station. We don't want to be a permanent bypass. We don't want to see trains continually going around us. That is to say, we want to see that transportation system continue, but we want to make sure that it's from city to city. That means Main Street Station, and not the Staples Mill Road station. And from what I've heard and from the president and from all of the national transportation authorities, that the commitment to high-speed rail is city to city, connections for passengers to have an opportunity to move from urban area to urban area, multimodal solutions, and that means that Main Street Station has got to be in the paradigm. And so we support the passenger rail project for Norfolk, but we need to reaffirm and redouble our efforts on several things for the future for the entire network. And as I close, let me just mention about four things. One is that we would like to reaffirm that the CTB will have a commitment to high-speed rail through Main Street Station. And I understand that you plan to take some action in that regard today, or at least something is before you. And I want to thank you in advance for your good efforts in that regard, and particularly Mr. McCarthy, Jerry McCarthy, for the wonderful job he has done in representing us. Thank you so much, Jerry. Second, we need to make sure that we get all of the preliminary engineering studies and EIS studies for the $600 million worth of projects completed so that we're ready to reapply through federal ARRA funds when they next become available. The preliminary studies cost about $10 million, and those funds have been promised to move that forward. Third, we need to exert all efforts from the CTB, the governor's office, the secretary's office, local officials, regional officials, and business community in Hampton Roads and Richmond. Together, we've got to get congressional support to get big dollars for high-speed rail. And that's not anything new, but it's worth mentioning again that we've got to put all of our shoulders to the wheel. Fourthly, if the North Fork project is going to take 3 years to complete, then let's use that time to do everything possible to get the S line through Main Street Station ready to go for the opening of the line. Just as it is envisioned to go another way, the A line, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't keep pushing to have it go through everybody's number one choice, and that's Main Street Station. And then finally, I think I said finally before, but this is really the finally. Railroads and Amtrak need to sit down and talk with the secretary, local and regional officials about how to make Main Street Station whole. We recognize that there are obstacles, that there are challenges, but we also believe that they are not insurmountable and that we can overcome them. And so we want to get everybody to the table, CSX, Norfolk Southern, Amtrak, all of the locations, the localities, the region, and the state government to the table so that we can talk about how to make sure that Main Street Station is included in the end game and in the end product. So thank you so much for listening to me today. It's been a pleasure and a delight to come to these hallowed grounds and this sacred place to be able to make this statement. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you very much. Why don't we go to the first item on the agenda is the National Capital Region Transportation Planning Board, Jerry Miller.
Hello and good morning. I'm really glad to be here today. We drove down from Washington and the traffic was fine in the direction down here, but it was awful in the other direction. I was glad to leave this morning. My name is Jerry Miller, and I'm here today as the Director of Program Coordination in the Department of Transportation. We're part of the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments, or COG. I wanted to mention that David Snyder, who is the councilman from Falls Church, he's our current chair of the Transportation Planning Board. And he would have liked to have been here today with me, but unfortunately he is out of the country on business. The summertime has made it difficult for us to schedule an elected official, so I do not have an elected official from our board here today. I'm also standing in for Ron Kirby, who is the Director of Transportation Planning. Ron also looked forward to being here, but he was recently invited to moderate a panel at the Surface Transportation Reauthorization Outreach Meeting called by Secretary LaHood. The Deputy Secretary David Tyer of Virginia is up there right now, and the Secretaries of DOT, of DDOT, Maryland DOT, and the General Manager of Metro are on that panel. So Ron is moderating that panel on the reauthorization. So in his stead, I'm going to try to provide an overview of the TPB, as we call it. I'll go over what it is, why it's unique, some challenges we're facing, and where we see ourselves going in the near future. The TPB is a multi-state, multi-jurisdictional entity. We have 35 members who are elected officials and senior staff from state and local transportation agencies in the region. They're listed on the slide. It also includes ex officio members from the Federal Transit Administration, the Federal Highway Administration, and the National Park Service. This map shows our planning area. It is quite large. The planning area is shown in the shaded area. It's about 3,000 square miles. That area contains about 5 million people with 3 million jobs. If you see the green outline around the edges there, that includes, we call that the modeled area. It incorporates the adjacent counties to our planning area. And we include the information, the jobs and population in those areas so that our travel demand forecasting models are more accurate because a lot of the jobs and housing influences of those regions come into our region.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Of all these, there's Spotsylvania, you only include half of the county. Everybody else, the other communities or the entire county, is there a reason?
That's an interesting observation. I don't know why. I mean, this is a model area that we have our zones, traffic zones, and we're undergoing a major change to that. So I believe the full county in the new version will be expanded. But it incorporates most of the population and households in that area. The transportation is critical to maintaining the economy and the quality of life in the Washington region, and the TPB has a key role in identifying the transportation needs and conducting the planning process to ensure that federal transportation funding can go to our region. It also provides a forum for coordination between and among the three states, and we provide technical resources for decision making. The planning process is federally funded. 80% of our planning money comes from the federal government. 10% is local funding, and the state provides 10%. We receive MPO planning money from the federal and state money by formula in Virginia and Maryland and then the District of Columbia. One of the key documents that I imagine you're all familiar with is the TIP, or Transportation Improvement Program. In the Washington area, we do an update of that annually. We have a six-year horizon in our TIP, and we spend a lot of time and effort making sure that it meets a number of federal requirements, including financial constraint, air quality conformity, and public involvement. The Virginia portion of our TIP is included by VDOT in the STIP, or state TIP, for federal approval. And VDOT coordinates with the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority to provide the actual project funding and funding levels that are shown in the Virginia portion of the Washington, D.C. TIP. The other key document that we are required to produce is what we call the Financially Constrained Long-Range Plan, or CLRP. Again, we do an update annually. It contains over 750 projects. The current plan has a 20-year horizon to 2030, but we're working this year and expect the board to adopt a new plan that will go out to 2040. It will also have some improvements in terms of the much finer grain zone system and a new travel demand model, so our estimates of forecasts should be more accurate. This slide, we try to show sort of the idea that the only projects in the constrained long-range plan can be programmed in the TIP, i.e. get federal money. So the squeeze means that in the future, funding cannot be reasonably anticipated to be identified, then if there are new roads and transit improvements shown in various plans that other localities, state and local people have made, they can't receive federal dollars. You know, for example, the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority has a plan that's called Transaction 2030 Regional Transportation Plan, and that identifies a large number of critical transportation projects for Northern Virginia. But most of those are beyond the projects that can be funded in our plan. I understand the MBTA has just embarked on doing an update to their plan that's going to go to 2040 also. We have quite a considerable amount of staff expertise. We have our own travel demand modeling group, and we do a lot of travel monitoring, traffic counts and traffic observations. We do forecasting. We have an extensive geographical information system, maps and internet access. We have expertise in a number of other areas, including traffic management operations, freight planning, bicycle and pedestrian planning, safety planning, and land use and transportation integration. I'll just go over some of the current challenges and what we're trying to do about them. This slide presents what we sort of have identified as the key forecast trends for the region as a whole. This isn't just for Northern Virginia, this is for the entire area, but some of these trends are quite dramatic. Over the next 20 years, The jobs are projected to outpace population growth, and as you may be aware, much of our region's population growth, employment growth, is in Northern Virginia. Transit use is expected to increase dramatically, up 34%, and the road system will see big increases in vehicle miles per travel and lane miles of congestion. Unfortunately, there will be not enough increase in new lane miles. This isn't too legible, but it's in terms of an impression, this shows what we see in terms of changes in congestion over the next 25, 30 years. By 2030, there's a few places where congestion is forecast to improve. For example, sections of the Virginia Beltway and on I-95, where the hot lanes will be opened, the red will disappear. But congestion will worsen in many other locations, for example, on I-66, the Dulles Toll Road, and large portions of Maryland's Beltway and on 95 in Maryland. So congestion is going to get worse in many places. The same picture, even more dramatic on the metro side. And what this slide doesn't show, this shows the bleak picture in 2030, but we're already experiencing, metro rail cars and platforms are already experiencing real congestion problems well before 2030. So metro is one of the major challenges we're facing, metro capacity. I wanted to highlight three major projects that at least are under construction in our region. These are multi-billion dollar projects. You're probably familiar with all of them. The Intercounty Connector is in Maryland. Rail to Dulles, of course, is a $5 billion project. And the Beltway Hot Lanes are under construction. And all of these projects are funded significantly with contributions from user tolls. And Rail to Dulles also includes major funding from property owners through development districts. Now, of course, tolls are a good source for financing major projects like this, probably in the future, but the region still needs to identify significantly additional resources to maintain and expand most of the transportation system in our region. I wanted to highlight three programs. These are not really planning programs. They're certainly not required under the federal planning process. They are operating programs, and they've been designed to meet the needs of the people who live in the Washington region. They are funded jointly by all three state DOTs, and the TPB administers them. The first one, the Metropolitan Area Transportation Operations Coordination Program, or MATOC, really grew out of the experience, which was not that happy, on September 11th in terms of congestion all over the road system and on our metro system. It has been designed and has evolved over the years to help the three DOTs and Metro communicate and coordinate their responses during those transportation incidents that can cause major tie-ups. Every day, sometimes twice a day, you have an accident, say in Maryland, and the ripple effects can come, cause delays in Virginia and vice versa, same way in the district. So MATOC enables the agencies to try to recognize and detect these ripple effects sooner rather than later, and it's been set up to share information, real-time information, and help them coordinate their actions. It does not deal with the incident. It deals with the ripple effects. The agency that has the incident is the one that has the jurisdiction, but it's the ripple effects that we are trying to coordinate. Commuter Connections is a term for our longstanding regional ride-sharing program. It's a major program, began in 1974, has a $5 million budget. It provides ride-sharing services for people to use transit, carpools, and van pools. It provides a significant technical assistance to employers and people to telework, and we have a guaranteed ride program. The last program is called Street Smart. This is began in 2002. It's a public education program focusing on pedestrian safety, and it runs radio ads and sometimes TV ads, and tries to organize events in concert with the police to highlight the needs of paying attention to pedestrian safety issues. This summarizes four critical issues. As you all know, the state and local governments are struggling to fund essential projects. And the way we see that, or what how it affects us most directly, is in the TIP and the CLRP that we're currently doing. Virginia and Maryland have had to remove or significantly delay projects in the constrained long-range plan. Our metro system has raised fares dramatically in the last few days, and we still face at least a $3 billion need for future funding if the system is going to be able to adequately address its maintenance, rehab, and safety problems. And, of course, growth and congestion on our roads and transit system continue. Recently, at least in the last year and a half, the federal context is changing, has provided some new opportunities. The Safety Lou legislation, as you may know, the Federal Transportation Bill, has been extended by Congress to the end of this year. And the House passed a comprehensive reauthorization bill last year, actually, but the Senate has not addressed it yet. The administration has not actually put any specific proposals for its reauthorization. And the big issue is that you need new federal funding, and so people talking about raising gas taxes or other means, but that's the hang-up. The administration has introduced initiatives that we've responded to. It's called the federal livability and the multimodalism. And the most important, the most dramatic one that we were successful was in February of this year, the TPB received a $60 million grant under the U.S. Tiger program to implement a regional priority bus network. I think there were almost 1,300 applications nationwide for $1.5 billion, and only 3% of them were funded. So we were quite proud that we were one of the winners of the Tiger Grant. Right now we're working with the five project owners. Two of them are in Virginia, Alexandria, and the Potomac Rapid Transportation Commission are project owners, and the rest others are in Maryland and the district, and then the transit system, Metro. Currently, we're working on a Tiger II grant. This is similar to the Tiger grant, but it's using U.S. DOT money. And the TPB plans to put in an application for $15 million for a regional bike sharing project. This bike sharing project was part of our original Tiger I grant, but it wasn't funded. So we're going to submit it again and see if we have any success. We're also working on a HUD Sustainable Communities Regional Planning Grant. We expect to, we're not taking the lead on that. It's the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments will submit the grant. It's to HUD. It's for $5 million to support improvements to the multi-jurisdictional regional planning efforts. And it's a comprehensive approach that would improve integration of housing, transportation, environmental impact, and economic development. We really hope that it will strengthen the link between land use and transportation, because that's so critical to addressing congestion long-term in our region. In all of these new opportunities, there's been a new focus on identifying the full benefits and costs of multimodal transportation improvements at the federal level. In conclusion, transportation is critical to the vitality of the National Capital Region. And the TPB is proud to be an integral part of solving its transportation challenges. On behalf of Chairman Snyder and the board, we look forward to working with the Commonwealth Transportation Board to determine solutions to these challenges. Thank you very much, and I would be pleased to answer questions.
All right. Are there any questions?
Yes. Following up on Mr. Sterling's question a few minutes ago, and thank you for that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to request that if we could have a report on why that Spotsylvania was not all of Spotsylvania was included, and I see where the line is drawn, but in my head I'm not sure exactly, you know, where.
Okay.
And I would like that if we could have that sent to the Fredericksburg District Administration Office. I was believing go through channels, so I would like to, you know, for them to receive that.
Very certainly.
Please, and because transit in our area is very important, as well as transportation, road building, and whatever. Go back to, if you would, to slide 10. And the forecast trends 2009 to 2030, population 22% and jobs 29%, we have something to look forward to?
Well, we have to look forward to more of what we've experienced, only maybe worse. It's hard to quantify the impacts of this growth, but our projections show that there's going to be a lot more people. In fact, the good news is there's a lot more jobs, but that results in from the regional perspective, we have to import jobs from farther and farther out.
That's what really caught my eye. I mean, that's a prediction that I haven't heard before, and so I'm very happy, to hear that. And of course, and another reason for that is the jobs, of course, most of them are in the metropolitan area up in Washington, in Fairfax, and et cetera. But into Stafford County and Spotsylvania, that's where many of them choose to live. And that's why absolutely that, all of the transportation issues, and I think the hot lanes are supposed to, whenever, will probably go down to the Massaponics area, which is in Spotsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I would like to know that also. And also, as I stated before, transit is very important in those areas at this time. And I would appreciate the report on where that stops so that we could address it more, Mr. Chairman, please.
I just would point out there is an MPO that deals with that area, directly.
That.
And what the map showed with that line just showed the area that we include in our models. But I will clarify that, and I believe that our new model area will include the whole county.
Yes, and I do appreciate the MPO. We have a good MPO, but also that the Fredericksburg administration, district administrator, is certainly involved in that, and I would like for them to receive it.
Ms. Miller, I'll have our district administrator give you a call, Quentin Elliott.
Okay.
Okay. Are there other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Sterling.
On your the model that you show, which I'm looking at, I guess it's slide, was it 11? And then I look at your current critical issues, which you have on slide 15. And you're not making mention of the BRAC moves to either EPG or the MARC Center right there off 95. I don't see those sort of reflected in the model and what that will do. Have you looked at those? How concerned are you? Most of the rest who've looked at that see that as having not only, let's just say, a significant impact might be minimizing the impact it'll have once those open up.
Yes, what I've presented here was the end point of our long-range forecast. We do forecasts at, at 10-year intervals, so we have 2020 forecasts. A couple of years ago, when BRAC was first proposed, we did a detailed forecast of the impacts, of the BRAC impacts, not only in Virginia, but in Maryland. It doesn't look good, particularly right around the areas.
But you don't have it addressed in your critical issues.
No, we didn't identify BRAC. I mean, partly because as an MPO, we're sort of reacting to whatever is being proposed. I mean, in Virginia and some places in Maryland, I mean, the DOTs particularly are pressing Congress or anybody to try to find resources to put in improvements to deal with the issue. But we have not done any analysis recently to look anything specific regarding the impacts. When we did it, it wasn't good.
So you don't have any specific projects or things that you'd put on the table under your six-year plan or your constrained long-range plan?
They will have to be, and they are, if they're funded, they are in the TIP and the plan. And some projects that have been funded are in the TIP and plan. But the problem is that they're trying to get projects funded, and as soon as they will, we won't have any trouble putting them in the plan.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, a question. I just want to make sure I'm clear that in the long-range plan, you are constrained that if there's not an identified revenue source, then a possible solution to MARC Center or wherever just can't be part of the plan.
Right. And that's the threshold. And so we have some examples where we've used the private sector or tolls or new identified sources of funding. But at the state and federal and local level, certainly in the short term, right now, people are doing the opposite. They're taking projects out of the plan or delaying them. Things that were supposed to be done by 2020 are now being said they're going to be done by 2035.
But a priority of where improvements should be made can't necessarily be part of the plan because it's unfunded.
Right. And that's, I think, the value of Northern Virginia. You know, the 2030 plan includes a number of critical projects, and we've not put them in our plan because there's no money. And that's a lot of what the TPB gets involved in, is when does they feel comfortable that the money's been identified.
Mr. Rich.
Mr. Chairman, in light of discussions about resources and money, which is an important question, have you ever done any a study about the costs added by the Davis-Bacon Act to all of these projects?
You mean that labor protection?
Yeah.
No.
Can you do that for us to let us know the incremental costs that are involved with that?
I want to. My first reaction is I wouldn't know how to do such a study. That's been a part of law for so long.
It could be quite significant, correct?
It could be, but I mean, as a transportation planning person, I mean, it gets into assuming what the assumptions of the cost of things would have been with and without it.
Right.
For a long period of time. I would be reluctant to undertake something. I think that's the kind of study that a university or somebody, you know, you need an economist and some other kinds of people. We're transportation planners and engineers. I appreciate what you're suggesting, but I don't think we...
Maybe that's something that VDOT could look into.
Okay. I'll note that and see if we can look into it. Mr. Coulomb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for being here. I have a question, a small question, and a couple of others. On the 17 slide, the state will more focus on benefit cost-based planning. Can you expand on that point just a little bit more? What does that mean?
Well, historically, USDOT funding is quite modal. FTA money has a series of criteria for assessing transit improvements and looking at certain benefits and costs and meeting various criteria. For example, cost per new passenger using the transit system. The highway system has a set of criteria for eligibility and assessing highway projects, and then rail and freight and airplanes, that sort of thing. What the administration has been proposing, what they really put on the table with the Tiger grant application process, is a more comprehensive benefit cost analysis, not only looking at the direct transportation benefits and costs, but the broader ones, air quality, air pollution, impacts on climate change, try to look at some of the long-term impacts on land use and development, economic development. So a much broader, comprehensive identification of benefits and costs, and not modal specific. Have the same criteria for all the modes. Get away from the fact that certain, you know, you can, if you're doing a project in an assessment in a corridor, that, you know, FTA is going to try to get, you know, give you money if you do, show these sort of benefits, and highways are giving you money if you do that. So that's where the federal program is tending towards. In the House bill, there was quite a lot of specificity trying to move the USDOT into that, in that framework. Try to get away, they use the term silos, that all these funds are in silos, and that sometimes creates inefficiencies. You go towards the money rather than what's the best solution.
So, Mr. Chairman, to reiterate Mr. Rich's point about the possibility of efficiencies, that might lead, or could lead, in your opinion, could it lead to consolidation of some of the 100-plus federal programs, and cut down administrative costs, speed up processes, you know, and that and actually give us sort of an investment-based infrastructure.
That was recommended by one of the commissions that was, Congress proposed, really to streamline, to get them down to six different things. The House bill had some of that, and of course, everyone has been advocating for this. The problem that comes out, I think, is because you have people with vested interest in those pots of money and those administrative processes, they know how to play those games, that they're all reluctant to give it up, particularly if there's not any new resources. So Ron Kirby has made a couple of presentations along the lines that we could increase and improve our operational organizational efficiency at the federal level, but you need to have a little more money or a lot more money to make that happen. Just moving the efficiency without any more money is probably not going to work.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I know that you're aware that CTB itself has, in the Commonwealth of Virginia in the last couple of years, has really worked hard on trying to link this land use decision-making with transportation decision-making in a much more direct way to make sure that what we are building and what we are expanding actually give us those benefits. I want to go back, Mr. Chairman, to slides 10 and 11. It's kind of the essence of the challenge we face, too. It's clear on slide 11 that there will be some improvements in congestion, and they're directly related to the additional investments in transportation that are being made, for example, the Beltway Hot Lanes project. And yet, there's no indication on slide 10 that what we can see is the growth that's going to occur, the transit work trips, and so forth, will be matched by additional capacity, not just in lane miles, but in transit capacity and so forth. How does the TPB balance those factors that you need a longer-term look at what really is needed, and yet you're really driven in the constrained long-range plan by the revenues that happen to show up in the short term?
Well, we have been engaged in various processes to identify the needs. There's been proposals recently that TPB develop an unconstrained plan to try to bring together, like the Northern Virginia unconstrained plan with Maryland and the district, to make it clear that there are quite a bit more needs beyond what we have. I think that the reluctance of the board so far to do that is the frustration that, you know, most people have not been happy with the way our constrained plan works. They don't like it, how it works in the short term, and when we forecast it, it even works less. So it's a question, you know, the TPB is not an advocacy group. It's not, you know, at least our planning process is not set up to try to influence funding directly. I mean, we try to provide objective facts and plans and the impacts of those decisions. But many, many members of the board, and we have public comments. For example, Bob Chase and the Alliance have been to the board regularly making various same points that you do, that the TPB's process, which is, you know, could be characterized as an exercise in futility. We've got to, you know, put together things that everyone knows are not adequate and move on. But if we can't, I guess my first reaction to that is that if we don't do this, we don't get any federal money. So we do have to go through that process. The federal money is part, a significant part of what we need. And it does, it's an educational process. Every year we do an update to our plan, and every year, usually the trends that we'd like to see improve don't improve. We've been doing this for 10 years. We do we're in the process of doing a new financial analysis, projecting the revenues and costs and needs over the next 30 years to 2040. And it's worse.
Mr. Chairman, a final comment, if I may. The private sector, when it faces transformational elements or fundamental change, actually the successful companies or organizations step back and re-engineer their processes and their systems and their makeup and their governance to be able to better respond to a new set of challenges or the speed of the same set of old challenges. Is the MPO process really working for the National Capital Region, or should we be looking not just at a reauthorization of the transportation system, but sort of a reorganization of our various groups and decision-making bodies to give us something that's much more relevant and can help drive decisions out of the needs identified as opposed to just simply out of revenues that happen to show up in the short term?
Well, I would certainly say I think that the MPO process can be improved. You know, it's a planning process rather than a programming or funding process. The House bill did actually create a metropolitan program that would provide direct funding, not for planning, but for actual implementation of projects to metropolitan areas, and the MPOs could have a significant role. And there are some MPOs in this country that do have control of hundreds of millions of dollars that they program. The dynamic would be much different if the TPB was actually programming funds, you know, particularly if it was a $10, $15, $20, $100 million kind of thing, than if it was just trying to coordinate the three states and metros funding to make a coherent plan. Now, that is a lot of MPOs and at the national level have advocated that. And I think, I personally, I've been at the MPO 20 years, I think it would be very useful if we had some money that we could bring to the table, try to leverage some of the things. And I think we would have a different dynamic if we were a player rather than a program.
Thank you. All right. Can't help but like to make a comment on what Mr. Coulombe just brought up. That is this issue about how we go about the allocation and appropriation and authorization of money. So I had a recent opportunity to give a presentation that you were at about to a general overview of how we go about this in the state. And it's the three A's, right? We have the legislators appropriate the money, and then the CTB, we're supposed to allocate the money, and then we have VDOT or whoever the agencies are to authorize the money. And what struck with me is would be a fourth thing, that's accountability. There's none of it in that system. And I, coming to what you're saying is that, you know, the money, we don't really have a feedback loop that says, well, as any business would do, gosh, my revenues may need to go up or maybe my costs. We don't have any of that feedback flowing through. So I'd just like to add on what Mr. Coolmates brought up. The more we can get accountability to the people who actually have the monies, the better off we will be as far as getting efficiencies, whether it's land use or the use of the transportation projects or what have you. So I know that's not exactly what you were talking about, but it struck me as you were going through here exactly what you said, futile. I think that's probably a good word in some of the exercises we go through. So thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Miller, thank you very much.
I put a copy of our latest annual report on your desk, and it describes the Tiger Grant in a lot more detail and some other programs. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak before you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have the Winchester Frederick MPO, Mr. Price.
I believe I have a presentation. I'm Chris Price, Executive Director of the Northern Shenandoah Valley Regional Commission and Secretary of the Winchester Frederick County Metropolitan Planning Organization. With me today is Mr. Richard Schickel. He's the Chairman of the Winchester Frederick County MPO and Chairman of the Frederick County Board of Supervisors. Mr. Schickel would like to make some opening and welcoming remarks for our region, and then I'll guide you through our presentation.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I would have liked to have thanked Secretary Connaughton for this opportunity, but I understand he's on a well-deserved vacation. For those of you who are here and had something to do with MPOs being able to address you, I say thank you to you. It's good to see Dr. Davis, my previous boss for 25 years, and it was a pleasant surprise to see Jim Rich, who have had many, our paths have crossed often, and we've worked together often as a new member of your board. My name is Richard Schickel, and I am Chairman of the Frederick County Board of Supervisors and Chairman of the Winchester Frederick County Metropolitan Planning Organization. In a few minutes, you will hear from Mr. Christopher Price, who is the Director of our Regional Commission and Secretary to our MPO. Mr. Price will tell you of our location, history, and primary priorities. I wanted to give you a prelude to his remarks. It has been a difficult task for me to learn what an MPO is, what it is required to do, when it is supposed to do its thing, and how does it do it. With the help of a great VDOT staff and the Regional Commission employees, I have learned that an MPO is all about coordinated planning. Coordination planned between municipalities, coordination planning with stakeholders, coordinated planning with the Stanton District, coordinated planning with the Federal Highway Commission, coordinated planning with the railroad folks, and specifically today, coordinated planning with the Commonwealth Transportation Board. I would be lying to you if I told you that I thought the MPO always makes sense. What I can tell you honestly is that we are trying very hard to make the Winchester-Frederick County MPO a useful, productive endeavor, and at this point we think we are successful. I trust that many of you went on tour of Frederick County when the Commonwealth Transportation Board met in Winchester not so long ago. I was out of town and unable to attend, but I was very involved in what you were shown. The purpose of the tour was to highlight how Frederick County and the City of Winchester have worked hard to overcome the transportation funding challenges. Through the use of partnerships with private developers, aggressive but not excessive proffers, and innovative financing such as community development authorities, we have worked diligently to help transportation facilities keep pace with our rapidly escalating usage in Frederick County. What do I mean by Frederick County's rapidly escalating usage? Let me give you some statistics. Frederick County has about one-fourth of the population of Loudoun County to our east. However, Frederick County has nearly one-half as many vehicle miles traveled as Loudoun County. To figure out why, one only has to look at Interstate 81, its junction with Route 66, and its intersections with Route 50, Route 11, Route 522, all in Frederick County. While we have the ability to make sure that our new development pays its way, we have no way to make drivers coming from somewhere else and going to somewhere else pay their fair share, or any share for that matter. Unfortunately, the primary and interstate roadways they use are the most underfunded, in need of redesign in our area. Spending an evening or morning rush hour at any of our local I-81 interchanges, and you will see very clearly the issues that I speak about. What are the tools that we use to make sure that our new developments pay their way? In Frederick County, you will find the model used for the new state legislation requiring the use of urban development boundaries. This is a tool that has been used in Frederick County for many years to make more intense development within a defined area while protecting the character of our rural areas. In addition, Frederick County is the first locality in the state to adopt a transfer of development rights program, as recently enabled by the state. We continue to aggressively develop and use tools that help reduce overall development impact and concentrate traffic in pre-planned areas of the county. This makes road improvements that do not get done much more cost-effective than trying to improve all the roads in our region after it is too late. Our region continues to be beset by transportation funding challenges that cannot be borne by a new development alone and the costs for which our local taxpayers cannot reasonably bear. Congestion in Winchester-Frederick County area continues to worsen in spite of our many efforts. Our most urgent need is planning money. Planning money will ensure that the development pays for and or allows for the right things to happen later during better times. I'm not saying that we won't need right-of-way money and construction money, but I am saying that the planning design money is the most important thing in the Winchester-Frederick County area right now before it's too late. I look forward to working with you in any way that I can, and I thank you for listening to me. Be glad to answer any questions.
Questions? Thank you.
Mr. Price will give you the details.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Schickel. By way of orientation for those of you that were unable to make the trip to Winchester and Frederick County, our MPO area is directly to the west of the National Capital Region's planning service area. We were established in 2002 and consist of the localities, the City of Winchester, the urbanized portions of Frederick County, the town of Stephen City, which is south of Winchester, northern borders, the West Virginia state line. Our census, our MPO boundary areas, like all MPO areas, are based on principally on population density. And given the rapidly rising population and travel trends within our region, we expect that those boundaries may change following the release of data from Census 2010. We're the northernmost point in Virginia, bisected by Interstate 81, 7 miles north of the I-66 interchange, and we're approximately 50 miles west of the Dulles International Airport. So clearly we're in a region that it's a metropolitan area, part of a rural region, but significantly impacted by the urbanization to our east. The Winchester-Frederick County metropolitan area is the economic, education, and cultural hub of the northern Shenandoah Valley. And I mentioned it is a rapidly growing region, as visitors can clearly see. And some of the statistics on the next slide will demonstrate that. In 2000, the Winchester-Frederick County population was just under 83,000. Today, it's approximately 104,000, representing almost half of our entire region's 225,000 residents. We saw some demographics from the National Capital Planning Region, 5.5 million residents over 3,000 square miles. So while they have 50 times more residents than our urban area, they're only three times as dense. So we're rapidly growing. In fact, we're the second most rapidly growing metropolitan planning organization area within the Commonwealth, just behind Northern Virginia and just ahead of Harrisonburg. And it is a significantly urbanizing area. Much of that is due to the migratory factors from folks coming from Northern Virginia. We have several major employers as well. Employment is strong in the Northern Shenandoah Valley. We have several national corporations, several regional companies, and several educational institutions that provide a strong local and growing local economy. It's something that our economic development folks are working hard to try to augment. The more jobs that we have within the region, the less trips that we expect to have into Northern Virginia, which will help not only our transportation network, but that of the capital region as well. Major highways, we have major north-south facilities in Interstate 81 and paralleling that in Route 11 and Route 522. Route 37 serves as a principal bypass on the western side of Winchester, and Route 7 is a major east-west corridor connecting our region into Northern Virginia. Our MPO is administered by three committees which meet monthly. The Policy Board is our governing body, made up of elected officials and senior staff from the jurisdiction, and VDOT. Our Technical Advisory Committee principally are the planners and engineers of the jurisdictions represented, and our Citizens Advisory Committee are appointed by the Policy Board to represent the needs of our residents and the business community. Major projects are overseen by a project steering committee, which has representatives from both the Policy Board and the Technical Advisory Committee. And all of this is administered by my agency, the Northern Shenandoah Valley Regional Commission. Our MPO focuses on both supply management and demand management. And we became an MPO earlier this decade. Unfortunately, when we really got on our feet is when federal and state transportation money really seemed to come into some issue, particularly at the federal level. And so we've really tried to redo the way we think about transportation investments in our region to try to maximize what we can do on a local and regional basis. And a lot of that is supply management. We key on system preservation. We've done a lot of access management projects on our major thoroughfares in cooperation with VDOT's TMPD staff and the multimodal office to ensure that we're getting the best bang for buck out of system improvements that are made at the local development level. We've worked with VDOT staff to do safety improvements. We're examining alternative infrastructure improvements such as roundabouts, which are supported by the Commonwealth, and an efficient and cost-effective manner to move significant amounts of traffic through major arterials. And we do have some major system investments with requirements, which I'll talk about at the end of the presentation. We also look at demand management. We are a member of the Commuter Connections Program in Northern Virginia and the D.C. metro area that you heard about earlier. And we're always looking to expand local and regional transit options so that we're not just a commuter-oriented transit system, but that we're also doing a better job managing local and regional transit and integrating the three. Our agency does administer a long-distance commuter assistance program. We're working with the transit service providers to better expand and coordinate their service. And again, as I mentioned earlier, we're always looking for expanded employment opportunities to reduce the need of our residents to travel long distance for employment purposes. We have several priority projects that the MPO has been engaged in over the past several years. First of which is our current update to the 2035 long-range transportation plan. Our MPO's first long-range plan was adopted 5 years ago, and we're nearing the end of updating that plan. That plan is the principal policy document of the MPO, where we identify our wish list of projects, if you will. There's approximately 150 projects that we would like to see, and our fiscally constrained list, recognizing that only those projects that we can likely afford over the coming years will be pursued. That's a much smaller list, approximately a half dozen to 10 projects. We also are looking at some major investment and some system preservation projects on major corridors, including Route 37, 711, and 522, and a city and countywide transit services plan, which we recently completed, and I'll go into a little more detail on all of these. Our 2035 long-range plan, as I said, it's our principal planning responsibility required by federal law. It gives us the opportunity to work with our residents and our business community to develop local and regional transportation priorities that we can then advance to the state and federal government for funding consideration. It involves a significant amount of local stakeholder input. It ensures planning and programming coordination with the Commonwealth Transportation Planning Board so that you can identify what we have adopted as local and regional priorities and work with us in partnership to fund those priorities. Route 37 Shady Elm is a significant project, infrastructure improvement project within our region. Route 37 is the western bypass around Winchester. At its southern terminus with Interstate 81, it's directly adjacent to another interchange with Route 11. And about a mile to the west, there's a proposed interchange at Shady Elm Road to provide access to industrial park and other land development activities. This is a lot of activity to be happening in a very small segment of roadway, so we're taking our time working with available stakeholders to identify the economic developments of improvements to this area, recognize the transportation and land use challenges, and address the need to improve accessibility, traffic flow, and safety while still maintaining the critical access to Route 11. Route 11 is a major employment thoroughfare and transportation thoroughfare within our region, and anything we do that doesn't recognize the need to preserve access to Route 11 would be doing a disservice to our business community. This is the picture heading northbound on Route 11 as you approach Shady Elm Road. There's a construction project happening there right now. At peak hours, this is experiencing congestion in all directions, with critical congestion on the bridge that's only likely to get worse as development within this corridor continues. Route 7 is a major east-west corridor connecting Winchester to Northern Virginia and the Washington, D.C. area. It parallels Interstate 66, but it's the major thoroughfare that residents within our northern region use to commute into Northern Virginia. It has tremendous peak hour congestion issues at multiple points along the corridor. We work a lot with the jurisdictions to our east, Loudoun County and the COG, on commuter-based issues, but every trip that originates in the Winchester-Frederick County travels every mile of Route 7 through Loudoun County and the counties entering into Northern Virginia. So as critical it is to move people off the roads in Northern Virginia, it's just as or maybe more critical to ensure that the trips originating in our region have good access, better access, and other alternatives to traveling into Northern Virginia. As I mentioned, significant peak hour congestion issues. Recently, with the help of the FDOT Multimodal Office, we've identified access management improvements and demand management options that will allow us to preserve system capacity. By that, I mean safety improvements, small-scale road closures, road realignments, things that we can work with the development community as this corridor redevelops to make sure that we're doing our part to preserve system capacity and improve the traveling condition without major investments. This is an illustration of Route 7. It's the purple line to the north, and as you can see, as I mentioned, it is the major arterial for our commuters entering into Northern Virginia. Route 11 is a critical north-south arterial which runs parallel to I-81 and travels through several communities throughout the Shenandoah Valley. It contains urban, suburban, and rural segments, each of which has their own transportation challenges. Also experiences significant peak hour congestion and safety issues at several segments along the corridor. We're working on a study right now with VDOT's TMPD group, evaluating access management options, and we're considering alternative solutions, including several roundabouts along the corridor, again, to improve the efficiency of the corridor, maintain capacity, and keep the improvement costs as low as possible, recognizing the financial challenges that we have in funding infrastructure improvement projects. A picture of Route 11, it's the purple line to the west, paralleling I-81, and it is a principal arterial with travelers through our region as far north as Martinsburg and as far south as Harrisonburg. Route 522 is also a major north-south arterial, and we're currently engaged with a joint study with the Winchester-Frederick County Metropolitan Planning Organization and the remainder of our rural region to evaluate access management and safety improvements from Winchester all the way south into Front Royal. This is an important corridor from an economic development and a travel perspective because it includes significant commercial development, significant industrial development, the Virginia Inland Port, it's a major trucking facility, and it is parallel to I-81. This plan, we're currently in the public input stage, working with the local governments to make sure that they're happy with the transportation and design standards, and we expect that this project will be out for public review in the fall. There's a depiction of 522, and again, you can see the Virginia Inland Port, and there's several strategic locations of economic and commercial development along that line. Transit services plan. We have a very vibrant transit system within the city of Winchester and within several of our towns throughout the Shenandoah Valley. Currently, we've adopted a study to look at options to expand Winchester's transit service to provide fixed route service to strategic locations within Frederick County. We're also looking to better coordinate existing fixed route and demand response services with public, private, and nonprofit providers. We have a lot of small towns and the city which provide transit services. None of them go into their adjacent counties, and we think that's a real opportunity for better system coordination to get people from one system to another. And as I mentioned before, we operate the Valley Commuter Assistance Program, which is a long-distance commuter service program into Northern Virginia. We'd like to do a better job coordinating our local and long-distance commuters so that we can have vibrant park and ride and transit service centers, and people can, you know, get on transit service for their entire trip rather than having to travel a portion of it to get onto commuter services. While we can do a lot of projects alone or with the development community through system preservation, traffic signal timing, small-scale safety improvements, access management improvements, we do have major system investment priorities within the region that will require partnerships with VDOT, Commonwealth Transportation Board, and Federal Highways Administration. I just want to illustrate three of those. Each of these are on our long-range transportation plan, but combined they are too large to be on our fiscally constrained plan. We do not have enough money to accomplish these projects on our own. One is the completion of the Route 37 bypass. The orange line to the west is the existing Route 37. The green line to the east is the unfinished portion. There are a lot of developer proffers and local commitments to build segments of the eastern section, but we do need a major injection of financial capital to complete this project, and it's critical to the vitality of our region because we have several choke points within the urban area, and without completion of this critical bypass, those choke points will continue to get worse, ultimately affecting our economic development opportunities. In the middle of the map there, you can see we're looking at replacement of the I-81 interchange at exit 313. This interchange on I-81 accesses Route 50, Route 17, Route 522, several critical corridors running through the middle of the urbanized area. It is in significant need of replacement. Those first two projects, we have applied for Tiger II funding through the federal stimulus program, and we would appreciate and welcome the Commonwealth's support on those projects. And the final project I'd mention is the relocation of the I-81 exit on Route 307, or, I'm sorry, on exit 307. This is at Stevens City. Stevens City is bisected to some extent by I-81. The predominant residential areas are on the west. The predominant commercial areas are on the east. There are major choke points at that interchange throughout the day which prevent people from going to and basically crossing the bridge over I-81 to the point where we have emergency services problems, delivering emergency services from one side to the other. So it is critical that we take a look at that something is done on exit 307, and we have begun the planning work to advance the project for your consideration. With that, I thank you. I just would like to say that I've worked with several MPOs in Virginia and in Pennsylvania. I feel very comfortable in saying that our Stanton District staff and the Edinburgh Residency staff are among the finest that I've ever worked with. I certainly appreciate their continued support with us and the support of both BDOT Central Office staff and the Commonwealth Transportation Board. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions or comments.
Thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to thank them for the outstanding work they do in our area.
All right. Mr. Price, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next item is the HRBT Tone Independent Review. This is the 1 year today that we've, 1 year in July 2nd or 3rd, 2nd, that we had the flooding of the tunnel, and this is an update on where we stand. Dennis Heuer.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, good morning. As the Commissioner said, I'm Dennis Heuer, the District Administrator for Hampton Roads. About a year ago, I presented you a timeline of what happened back on July 2nd. Probably wasn't all that pretty. And today, I'm here to update you on what we've done in the intervening year. Efforts this past year have been to mitigate the causes, and essentially what it came down to was infrastructure, a pipe broke, and it came down to people and what they did and how they responded. So those two areas are being addressed through improvements and actions to reduce our risk as we go forward in the future. There's oftentimes to say, well, can you guarantee something like this would never happen again? I can't guarantee you that. But what I'm here to talk about today is the actions that we have taken and will continue to take to mitigate our risk. And we've broken them down into immediate, ongoing, and long-term actions. These are the reflection of the immediate actions that we took. The original design of the tunnel has a duct above the roadway surface, and it has a duct below the roadway surface. And all that water wound up in the lower duct. The tunnel was designed back in the 1950s, and we've had a recent design of the Monitor Merrimack in the 1990s. So in that intervening years and in current design standards for a tunnel with a roadway and ducts above and below, there never was and there continues to be no plan to address that water in that could potentially pool. That was not a risk that the designers originally contemplated. So what we've done is to mitigate that risk is the immediate action was put water detector sensors in there, something that would highlight and send an alarm to the control room, and I'll touch on that. We've also undertaken a design to put butterfly valves in there. And essentially what that means is should we detect water, the control room can actuate a vacuum system, open up a valve, the water can go into a pump system that we already have in existence and evacuate the water as well. We also found that we didn't have a computerized logging system for every event that happened. We had an electronic system, but it also relied on a manual logbook that the staff would actually make data entries to. We've immediately implemented the computer logging system for that. Really, the third one is the risk analysis. We internally looked and said we've got really four systems that we really should pay attention to. The fire suppression system, the drainage system, the electrical system, and the ventilation system. And that's formed our go-forward plan right now. And then number four, talking about the fire main replacement, yeah, we had a fracture in a pipe that was encased in concrete. And frankly, you know, cast iron pipe, like I said a year ago, you know, we have those in old 100-plus year homes, and we never think twice about it. We never really expected something to rupture like that. So we had a series of debates and evaluation on what is the best way to repair this. And we settled on a slip lining system an immediate repair and slip lining of the entire system. So what we've done is we've hired Parsons Brinckerhoff as a design builder, and they are underway with that plan of attack. Furthermore on this, we found out that we had somewhat of a training. The issue essentially was tunnel operations are an on-the-job training way of learning your job. So we've commissioned and worked with our learning center to come up with a structured plan which has classroom exercises as well as practical exercises. While that was being developed, we sat down with all of our traffic control supervisors, maintenance staff, and bridge tunnel patrollers to give them a better understanding of the holistic way which each tunnel operates. You know, in the medical profession, we all go to a specialist, and that specialist is focused on one part of our body. There's not too many general practitioners. So what we're trying to do with our folks is make them all general practitioners so that they know if something happens, they know what the consequences if they don't pay attention to the entire system. So in June, which was last month, we received our first learning package, if you will, from the Learning Center, and that focused on the traffic control supervisors. Those traffic control supervisors are the on-site management 24/7. So we figured that was the best place to start. And what we've also done, some practices, we've implemented a walkthrough by that traffic control supervisor of the mechanical systems once a shift. And we run 3 8-hour shifts. So everything gets a visual three times a day. I draw your attention to this particular slide. On the left here is what the person in the control room looks at. That's our industrial system monitor system. If you look at the little red things, they look like pumps. They are pumps. So when they come on, there's an annunciator. What we've added at the top is the detection system that I said we installed. There is a visual alarm there as well. We've also added below that readings for pressure. So if water pressure does drop, there is an audible show up and a visual that shows up on the screen. Now our control folks have a job. There's three people. There's a traffic control supervisor, there's the person that monitors these industrial systems, and then there's a third person that monitors the traffic flow, the cameras, and what's going on. On the other side here is, I stress the risk. What we did internally was look at what are the risks to our systems, and that's how we identified those four systems that I just mentioned. These are the recommendations that came forth from the panel. You know, I won't read them to you, but I would say that the panel brought forward recommendations on best practices from other tunnels around the Eastern Seaboard. We had representatives from Maryland. We had representatives from New York as well. So I covered the immediate. I'm going to focus on the meat of the presentation, which is on the next slide. So I'm going to dwell on this for a little bit. You know, the first area we're talking about the risk and first analysis of the key IF the recommendations. We hired Raylene and VMASC and ODU, and they delivered or are scheduled to deliver us a report at the end of month here on that risk. We looked at those four systems. We identify them as worthy of our attention, but we wanted to have an independent contractor look at it and give us recommendations from a maintenance standpoint, a training standpoint, and a holistic approach. So that's underway and looking forward to their report this month. Another recommendation was consolidate operations at the Traffic Operations Center. We just received a report from another consultant on that the end of month, June, and we are looking at and evaluating their recommendations and considerations on the cost, the facility impacts, and the infrastructure impacts from consolidating all of the tunnel operations into one location. On the inspection review process was also something that the panel discussed. I know our chief engineer is on the nationwide panel that is leading the effort to look at that. Right now there is no standard for how tunnels should be inspected, how frequently and such. This group is looking at right now, for example, every 2 years saying the mechanical systems ought to be looked at. But if you think, oh, well, they ought to be inspected, but then on the other hand, if you do extensive maintenance, if you do some rehab, why do you need to inspect all of the systems? So there's got to be some judgment that will be applied to that, and that's what this group is looking at as well. Their delivery is due in 2012. So, you know, I think we're getting close on that. Going to the second item here in the key projects, we've implemented another layer of redundancy here by looking to install flow sensors. Equivalent, basically, a pinwheel in the pipe that...
Could I ask a question, please?
Yes, sir.
What will actually be delivered in 2012?
Based a plan to review tunnels that will be patterned after the National Bridge Inspection Program. So we have right now definable standards for bridges. We know how frequently to inspect them. We know all of the things that need to be inspected and generated a report. And that's done nationwide. Everybody follows the same system. Right now, there is no similar system for tunnels. And that's what this committee with AASHTO, Federal Highway, and other trade groups that the chief engineer participates in will develop.
And it's going to take 2 years?
To have the definable standards on a nationwide, yes, sir.
Wow. Sure would be nice if you could figure out a way to speed that up. I mean, that's... I was educated as an engineer once upon a time, and I always thought that we did things faster and better. And I guess I'm a little bit surprised to hear it would take so long.
Well, for example, though, we do, and I reported last time, National Fire Protection Standards say you will test your fire system and pressure test it once every 5 years. This group is looking at that to say, is that enough? Should that be 1 year? Should it be 3 years? Should it be 2 years? Then, for example, we internally inspect everything on a recurring sliding 7-year basis. What should the standard be? We have our standard. I'm sure other tunnels, and you heard from Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel, because they have a bond and they have financial interest of outside entities, they do some inspections on a cyclic basis, on an annual basis. So, Mr. McCarthy, what is the best thing for nationwide in tunnels?
A perfectly great question. All I'm concerned about is why does it take 2 years to answer it? That's the part I don't understand yet.
Chief Engineer, who's going?
The Federal Highway Administration right now is establishing those. There's a notice out right now asking all states to put in their suggestions about what the criteria should be for tunnel inspections. And it's the process. The lengthy process is going to get to the federal government will come out with guidelines, just like we have for the bridge inspections that we have. And it's a process they go through that is rather lengthy. The subcommittee, the bridge subcommittee, AASHTO has been working with the Federal Highway Administration a couple of years on the tunnel, guidance on design, et cetera. And just the process to deal with all the states, to get all the approvals back and forth is what takes the time.
Well, and I don't blame VDOT, obviously, for that. I mean, it's just, you know, we're constantly being criticized for how come it takes so long to do everything in transportation. And this one just seems like a no-brainer. We've got some real issues that have to be addressed around the country. There doesn't seem to be a sense of urgency about it.
Well, several years ago, we established down in Dennis's area a movable bridge and tunnel team because there were no guidance in this area. And that's why Dennis mentioned we have a 7-year cycle now, because we set that up because we felt when we opened up the Monitor Merrimack Bridge, we had a brand new structure. We wanted to baseline that, and then we wanted to baseline all the other tunnels that we've had. So we've been working at this for some time, but to get it in the national thing, we're moving down the path maybe a little bit slow.
With all deliberate speed.
Thank you, Mr. Curling. The key on, if I go to the center of the slide here, talking about automated maintenance management system. That will tie into this inspection system where it will say these are the things you need to do preventive maintenance on. These are the things you need to do rehabilitation and rebuild on. These are the things that you need to inspect and at what frequency. So we've gone, right now we're relying on manufacturers' recommendations. We're looking at, like I said, a manual logging system. This system, as we envision it, will generate work orders, will generate tickets, and as the inspection or the repair or the rehabilitation is done, it will be entered back into that automated maintenance system. We set that out for a bid. The bids came in at three times what our estimated cost was. So we had a meeting on July 12th with the proposers to try and refine the scope and go through and eliminate some of the risks, and we're hopeful that rescoping will get a more reasonable price for that. I showed you that touch screen on the mechanical systems. We did not have that type of systems in the Monitor Merrimack tunnel. So we have since installed that in the, we have that out for pricing right now to install that in the Monitor Merrimack. There was talk about our incident diversion plans. We revisited all of those plans and re-coordinated with all the municipalities to make sure that they are updated and current and situated with the timing systems of the traffic lights in the municipalities. We have ongoing exercises with the FBI, Homeland Security, to test our tunnels and to make sure that they are safe and secure. And then the last one is we have a plan that's been developed on 511 outreach, but that one is being held in abeyance subject to funding. When I look to number four here, we have established within our groups here some work groups that will focus on and review the output of that maintenance management system. Are we, in fact, doing the services and the maintenance actions that should be undertaken? We have implemented and re-looked at our SOP with the I-95 Corridor Coalition to make sure that when we have an incident that lasts in excess of 2 hours, that we do make notification for them so the I-95 corridor can be highlighted. We use the Regional Concept of Transportation Operations, the RCTO, which is housed within the Transportation Planning Organization, or the MPO, in the Hampton Roads District to help us with this. Number five here is probably, in my opinion, the best thing that's come out of this. We've established a oversight committee to address tunnels on a statewide, and we had Commissioner Worley bless this concept, and we've already had our first meeting. The steering committee consists of the chief engineer, the chief financial officer, the chief strategic officer, myself as the DA with the tunnels on the east, and my colleague Richard Kaywood has the tunnels on the west. We're also focusing on the long-term actions, which I said really revolves around this oversight committee. And I'd just like to read you a portion of the charter, which is to provide organizational direction, decision-making, guidance, and support for the unique needs and challenges of the six tunnel facilities that VDOT owns and operates. And the overarching goal is to provide stabilizing influence so organizational goals and directives can be established, strategically planned for, and maintained. And I think it's that visibility, that coordinated effort at the central office location will help address the risk of these tunnel facilities as we move forward. The last bullet on here, the Federal Highway has and AASHTO have a program where they pick a topic and they have a scan and they go out and search for best practices. Well, we implemented that within our area of responsibility just recently and did a scan for my folks on the east to go cross-pollinate with the people on the west, learn what was going on, as well as went up to Maryland to look at their tunnels as well. So the practitioners that are on the ground are out actually scanning and learning from each other, which I think is a great benefit. You know, looking at the long term, we did initial damage control. We're now looking at a systemic approach. We're looking for and have received by independent contractors advice and recommendations, and we've established that oversight committee. So the next steps as we go forward, I think, will be to continue to build on and utilize this tunnel oversight committee, complete the contracts that we have underway, complete the work that is underway, and evaluate the input that we receive from our other contractors. So, ladies and gentlemen, subject to your questions, that completes my briefing. Are there questions?
No question, but a comment. Do understand the situation. You cannot foresee everything, and what happened with the cast iron pipe there. I would extrapolate that to suggest, encourage that sometime in meetings with your counterparts to suggest to everybody consider the same situation for risk analysis on things where we're not expecting it to get out of the box. I mean, something as similar to the cast iron pipe as the drainage system over in what we used to call Tidewater to
Hampton Roads.
What we used to call Tidewater to the possibility of the message boards glitching out and failing to warn about snow or fog, or worse still, sending the wrong message. Things that we can prevent that are analogous to this. You've done a good job of responding and proving system equals prevention, and share it with your counterparts and get us to look to prevent the similar kind of thing where we're not expecting it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Martin. I know in the district and some of my colleagues are adopting the risk-based approach, for example, on construction programs. And we can't touch everything on a construction project, but we need to be able to identify the major risks and then marshal our resources to help mitigate the risks so we can continue to improve on our on-time and on-budget delivery. So the risk-based approach has applicability in many of the things that we do in transportation.
Mr. Chairman, I would also like to add one suggestion. First of all, you answered the questions I had in the middle of the presentation by the end, and the idea of setting up the process whereby this is not just an incident response, but it's a pre-incident prevention program is very important. My advice would be to look very carefully and favorably wherever possible on what the private sector is doing in terms of risk analysis. It's something they do for a living. It's something they do because there's real money involved, and it helps give direction to even a strong engineering-based approach. So,
well, Ms. Kumai, to that, we have reached out to Parsons Marine Cohort, for example, doing that. And in my district here, I know we have used PB to help us define risk for some of our construction projects. So we are tapping into the private sector, and we'll continue to do that.
Yeah. And then, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to say, for my part on the CTV, I'm ready to help on the long-range investment plan. I think we understand that the failure of a certain road in a certain place is very different than a failure of a tunnel in a key place. So
I know from our perspective, we have a needs list somewhere over $85 million just in my four tunnels. And that's a good chunk of change.
You mentioned the private sector. You know, as the CTV representative, I sat on the Chesapeake Bay Bridge transport tunnel. And the way they approach it is they fix everything. They have a needs assessment where we're not inspecting. They're expect to maintain a certain level. And we just don't have the money in the state to do that. But that's how they approach it. And sort of it's sort of not a reaction, but more of a prevention program. And the economic life of this tunnel, do you have any idea what it was meant to be?
Economic life, it's hard to say because, you know, concrete and steel immersed in water and that pretty has an indefinite life. What wears out is those mechanical systems. For example, we have replaced the valves. And when we looked at it from our risk base, years ago, we said, gee, those valves in the fire protection system are the weak link, you know, just like valves in your home. If you don't exercise that valve, you have a burst pipe. Gee, how do I get that water turned off in the house? So we recognize that and replace them. But it's those other portions that we really need to address. And if we had the luxury of putting a $12 each way toll on there, we could do a lot of replacement before they break.
I'm just calling it as it is, Dennis. I'm just.
I was quibbling with my colleague just a little bit. He made the statement the Commonwealth doesn't have the money. That's not the truth. The Commonwealth doesn't have the will.
I'll second that.
Well, Mr. Davis, I think that's one thing that this Tunnel Oversight Committee will contribute to, is that the visibility for your consideration, and I know at the central office level, we'll get some attention to that.
An example, Mr. Chairman, would be in the private sector, if they didn't repair it and they had an accident, the liability is so huge that they have the motivation to do it. In the public sector, we wait until people die before we do things a lot of times, like what is being talked about here. It's very unfortunate.
What I would offer, though, is if I was had an unlimited pot of money, I would not have allocated any to the pipe at first. I would have done it the way, similarly, what we did do was replacing the valves and those things that are programmed to fail. But a cast iron pipe encased in concrete should have lasted for 100 plus years.
Okay. All right. There are no other questions. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
We have Rail Industrial Access Program by Kevin Page.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I'm here today to brief you on a rail industrial access application that came in from Greensville County. This is Wood Fuels Developers, LLC. Since the board is not meeting in August, we're briefing at the workshop and then asking for action at the action section of our meeting today, Mr. Chairman. Just a brief description of project location. This project is located in Jarrett, Virginia. One of the things we do like about the Rail Industrial Access Program is that this is a program that continues to build as the communities tend to build their economic development. This board approved several years back, as you see, it looks like a little round circle there just to the left of the arrow. We had a chip mill locate down there that Rayonier actually operates out of Golden Isles, Georgia. And Rayonier has worked to deal with Wood Fuels developers to also provide wood fiber to them because they make wooden pellets that are used for heating fuels and also for fuels for boilers and generation. Wood Fuels Developers LLC is developing the facility to develop and manufacture wood pellets. Our project, the Rail Industrial Access Project side of this development, is $617,800 total cost, which set with the employment and also the industrial economic development of the $18.7 million and the development of 39 jobs plus the 400 annual carloads brings this project to a recommendation from the Department of Rail and Public Transportation for $450,000, which is the maximum amount under the Industrial Access Program. This will take about 680 trucks a year off of the highway system, and again, this is very good for a community that in March had an 11.5% unemployment rate as compared to the state's unemployment rate of 7.6%. So these jobs will be very good for this area as well. The Greenville County Board of Supervisors has approved this and endorsed this project by resolution. CSX Transportation is committed to serve the project, and our Economic Development Partnership of Virginia has also endorsed the project. As we move forward, I share this with you on all of our projects. This is our criteria and evaluation system. In order to score for a recommended project, you have to score 50 points under our ROI, and this project scored 71, so it was a very strong performer on their evaluation. So as we move forward, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I'll close with saying that the Department of Rail and Public Transportation recommends this project for Greenville County Wood Fuels Developers, LLC. We'll be asking for action at the meeting following the workshop today. Thank you very much, and this is a new development and a new industry for this community. Thank you.
Are there any questions of Mr. Page? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we have base realignment and closure, Tom Farney, and this will also be two items on the agenda.
Thank you, Commissioner. I am Tom Farney. I'm the State BRAC Coordinator for VDOT. Before I begin, I would like to personally welcome Mr. Garzinski to the board. I don't know if he remembers, but about 15 years ago, the company he worked for built the house that I currently live in. It's still standing, so you did an excellent job. The commissioner asked me to provide you a brief update on the status of road improvements at our two largest growth installations, being Fort Lee and Fort Belvoir. Just to refresh your memory a little bit, Fort Lee is adding about 7,800 employees by September of next year. They're constructing over 4.5 million square feet of buildings on the property. They're about half completed. They expect the rest of it to be completed by July of next year. In 2007, VDOT hired a consultant to do a traffic study. The results of those studies indicated that about $30 million worth of road improvements were necessary to mitigate the impact of the BRAC relocations. Six of those projects have been funded. We're about 80% there. And I've listed several of the projects. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip these and go to this slide, which highlights the two major projects that are funded at Fort Lee. The first was funded by the CTB using ERA or stimulus funds. It was awarded last June of this year. It will be completed in 2012. That is after the employees move into Fort Lee, and we're hoping construction will go well. The final one I want to highlight is the last bullet. This is the only project that the Army has funded at Fort Lee. It's a roundabout project worth about $3 million. The status is, on your regular agenda this afternoon, you'll be asked to approve a memorandum of agreement with the Army and the Federal Highway Administration. The project is, again, 100% funded by the Army. The Army will be providing easements for the construction on their property. Again, Eastern Federal Lands, Federal Highway is administering the project, and VDOT's role will be to approve the plans, acquire any off-site right-of-way that may be necessary, and then accept it for maintenance once it's finished. Overall, I think Fort Lee is in a pretty good place. The localities have shifted funds from some projects to projects at Fort Lee, which will help mitigate some of the impacts. The stimulus project on the Route 36 corridor went a long way in helping mitigate impacts as well. So overall, I'm pretty comfortable that Fort Lee will be in a good place come September of next year. On the opposite end of the scale is Fort Belvoir. Just to refresh your memory a little bit, they're adding 19,000 employees, 4,100 at Main Post, which is accessed by U.S. Route 1, the Mark Center in the city of Alexandria off Seminary Road. The Washington Headquarters Services will be moving there. They're adding 6,400 employees. And then finally, the Engineer Proving Ground at 8,500 employees. In 2007, the Army did an environmental impact statement. An extensive list of road and transit projects were recommended, about $700 million. And that was just to keep things where they're at today, not to improve them to great levels of service. To date, we funded about half of that. We're about 50% there. Here's the problem. It's not only the BRAC movements along the corridor of I-95, it's also the existing military bases. With Quantico, Fort Belvoir, EPG, the Mark Center, the Pentagon, we have 84,000 employees that in September 2011 will be commuting in this corridor. The impacts will be immediate. Many of the employees that are moving out of leased office space that currently have access to the metro system will no longer be able to have that metro because these locations are not served by the subway. So the impacts will be immediate come September 2011. There most likely will be two choke points created. One will be at EPG at the Fairfax County Parkway interchange with I-95, and the other will be Mark Center at Seminary Road and 395. Just to give you a status of what we're doing out there to try to help mitigate the impacts, the Fairfax County Parkway Project phases 1 and 2, they're well underway. They'll be completed this spring, or, I'm sorry, this fall. We should be having a ribbon cutting hopefully in September. Fairfax County Parkway phases 3 and 4, those projects were funded by the CTB with stimulus funds. Phase 3 is to begin in the fall of this year, and Phase 4 is under construction and will be completed next summer. The other project VDOT has funded is the fourth lane widening of I-95. That is well under construction and will be completed in the spring of 2011 before employees start moving in to the EPG site. There's a picture of the phasing plan of the Fairfax County Parkway. Again, the yellow and green sections will be open to traffic this fall. The purple on the right-hand side of the slide are the what's called the DAR, or the defense access road ramps. The lower right-hand corner is the southbound I-95 off-ramp into the engineer proving grounds. That is under construction. The second one is a direct access ramp from the I-95 HOV lanes into the engineer proving grounds. Both of these ramps have been funded by the Army at about $36 million. You do have an agenda item today to approve a limited access control change on 95 for to allow the Army to construct the HOV ramp into EPG. That ramp is it will be reversible. It will have both AM and PM HOV ingress and egress for those employees. It also will provide I-95 northbound PM egress into the general purpose lanes. It will be a two-phased project. Currently, there's an interchange justification report that VDOT recommended approval of. It's under review by the FHWA, and we hope that we will get a positive outcome on that within the next few weeks. Your approval today, if you so decide to approve this resolution on your regular agenda, is contingent on FHWA approval. If they don't approve the interchange justification report or the limited access control break, then your resolution will basically become null and void. Again, it's 100% funded by the Army. Eastern Federal Lands Highway Division of FHWA is administering the project, and we will approve the plans, acquire right-of-way, and accept it for maintenance. And that's a picture of the phasing plan for the HOV ramp. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Mr. Gazette?
Yes, Tom. Is that going to be similar to the Prince William Parkway 95 commuter lot access then?
It will access a loop road within the engineer proving grounds that the Army will maintain. So it will provide access for those 8,500 employees that are moving to EPG.
I noticed you said didn't comment too much on Marks Center. I built two jobs in the Bailey's Crossroads redevelopment area. Seminary Road's a nightmare now. What are they going to do?
Yeah, just to, real briefly to give you an update of where we're at with that. We did at the request of the City of Alexandria perform a traffic study, an access study for Mark Center. We came up with an alternative that worked from a traffic standpoint. It did not work from a community standpoint. It impacted what was called the Winkler Nature Preserve. We had about 1,200 comments from local citizens not wanting us to impact the Winkler Preserve, so the Secretary made the decision to drop that alternative. We are in the process. We have obtained grant approval from the Department of Defense, and the City of Alexandria has agreed to pay half of another study where we're going to look at providing some short-term improvements to the seminary interchange itself, plus look at a longer-term improvement of an HOV ramp that will access the third level of the seminary interchange. It'll come out of the northbound HOV lanes and access the third level. So those studies hopefully will be getting underway within the next few weeks.
But the building will be occupied when? The
building will be occupied long before any of these improvements will happen.
If they're scheduled into this year, I guess. Can you send to everyone, I don't know if you have, the letter that the Secretary sent to Congressman Moran on what the impacts will be?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, Mr. Colomay.
Mr. Chairman, one comment. I'd just like to commend Tom for his work. This is probably the most difficult and complex and charged set of discussions that have gone on over the last few years. It has involved many players, each with their own, you know, temper level. And Tom's demeanor, as well as his experience and his knowledge, has really helped keep this process moving along, regardless of who was ready to chop it to pieces or pull it apart or keep it from happening. So personally, I think you've shown a tremendous amount of professionalism, and I wanted to acknowledge that in front of my colleagues, because often it is an individual like Tom in VDOT that actually makes these things work against all odds. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Mr. Coulet. But you haven't been in some of the meetings I've been in with the Army. So.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? That's the last agenda item. The Secretary asked me to be fair but be tough. And I know a couple members really have some other appointments. So I would ask if maybe we could just take a 15-minute break.
Mr. Chair, before you do that, I think I should announce that Mr. Bowie is not here, obviously, and some of you may not know. He's actually in the hospital. He had a heart attack on Saturday. He's in the hospital, and probably as we talk, he's undergoing bypass surgery. So I forgot to do that this morning, and I wanted to let everyone know your situation, why he's not here.
Thank you. I would propose that maybe just take a 15-minute break and get your lunch and come back to your seat, and then we'll try to start the agenda, because I know a couple members have expressed that they had some commitments, and if we could speed it along, it would be great. So the workshop meeting is hereby adjourned.